is the world we live in. And in 1980, our world had a population of 4,321 million people. And since then, it's been increasing at a phenomenal rate. Our world is made up of about 123 separate states, of which its people speak about 5,770 different languages. So it's a very complex world. And it's here that God has placed us in an age quite unlike any other age that this world has ever seen. Now, history is like an ocean. And we, unfortunately, are not able to view it from the security of some safe bank. We're in the middle of it, on a little raft of our own time and experience and perspective. And to try and map all the currents and the ebbs and flows of this ocean of history that we find ourselves in is very difficult. But we're going to try and do that in a very general, broad way this morning, so that we as God's people can really get an idea of what it is to really be part of this world in which he has placed us. Now, when the 20th century dawned, the sun never set on the British Empire. Europe had only one republic amid her monarchies. The influence of the USA on the world was minimal. Man hadn't flown an aeroplane. Radio hadn't been invented. It was a fact of life that every British family would expect to lose at least one or two children in infancy or childbirth. The name of Lenin was only known to the police, and Mao Zedong had only just been born. So that was the stage on which the century dawned. Now, to catch the pace and the scope of this century is impossible, certainly within the time limits that we have together this morning. But we can make a few general observations before we get into looking at these main currents. Our century, above all others, has been a century of abundance, the richest century that man has really exploited the earth's resources in a way never before. And yet it's a century of incredible want, with this morning half the world still hungry. It's been a century of violence, of unsurpassed wickedness engulfing the earth. For the first time in history, man is now capable of his own self-destruction. And yet also, strangely, it's a century of great gentleness. There have been international groups, national groups, voluntary government, who've really worked to try and make this world a better place to live in. To meet human need. There are welfare schemes, pensions, public health schemes, international aid schemes, all of which attempt to express gentleness in a violent world. It's been a century of freedom, a political, social and personal freedom, a freedom of movement, a freedom from disease, a freedom from tradition, freedom in sexual permissiveness. It's also been a century of anxiety. Very few guideposts as the past has been torn down, looking for something new, and people looking very much into a vacuum, as we'll see. But probably, if you want to use one phrase which names our century millennia, there it's been a century of revolution, with everything being turned upside down in a way never known before. Everything has changed. Between 1890 and 1980, the world population has doubled. Science has pioneered unimagined frontiers. Society has been shaken to the core. There's been an incredible gulf between the generations. It's been said that anyone born before 1945 will soon find themselves a stranger within their own world because the changes are so fast in taking place. On occasions during this century, people have believed utopia has arrived. At other times during this century, people have believed that all hope has gone. It's been marked by human achievement at every level. In 1913, Amundsen reached the South Pole. In 1953, Hillary and Tenzing stood on top of Mount Everest. 1954, Bannister ran the four-minute mile. 1968, Chichester sailed single-handed around the world. In 1969, Armstrong stood on the surface of the moon. And so it goes on. Every corner of our Earth has been explored and been marked by human activity, railroad, roads, dams, airports, which have sort of made this world, the whole sort of face of the earth has been changed. Now let's look at the first real force that has shaped the world in which we live in. And this has been the whole whirlwind of change, expressed particularly in the technological explosion, and particularly in the area of science and technology. Now, the 19th century was an amazing century for inventiveness in science and industry. But it's been this century that has really exploited that to the full. There have been breakthroughs at every level of scientific inquiry. Our understanding of the material universe has radically increased. Knowledge is advancing so fast that, you know, we just can't keep up with knowing about things. The number of scientific publications has just accelerated in almost every field. They say people with PhDs are people who know more and more about less and less. And, you know, that's the sort of mark of the times in which we live. In 1905, Einstein propounded the theory of relativity. He asked the simple childlike question, what would the world look like if I rode upon a beam of light? And as he answered that question, he not only shattered the scientific world, but its implications flowed over, shattering the way society began to think about things, the whole idea of relativity. In 1919, Rutherford smashed the helium atom. And as he did so, he said to his students, he said, we are now entering no man's land. The atomic age had been born. In 1962, Crick and Watson unraveled the mystery of the double helix and DNA, which are the building blocks of the human personality, the human being, and opened new frontiers of biology, which have had frightening sort of implications of genetic engineering and this kind of thing, which we'll look at a little bit later on. And scientific inquiry has had spin-offs into all sorts of areas. Space research has given us non-stick frying pans, hang gliders, frisbees and thermal blankets. And although scientific achievement has brought terrific benefits to mankind, there have also been turned to destructive and selfish ends, so that at the moment, every 2 weeks, enough money is spent on arms to feed and house and educate every person on Earth for a year. 1/4 of the world's scientists and engineers, and more than half of all the money that is spent on research and development goes directly towards producing weapons. Momentum is another mark of this whirlwind of change. In the 1800 years between Julius Caesar and Napoleon, nobody moved faster than on the back of a galloping horse or riding in a sailing ship. The advent of the steam engine obviously was a sign of changes that were on the way. This century really has witnessed unthought of increases in momentum and transport. The age of steam has evaporated in the wake of the petrol, diesel and electronic engines. Road and rail cross every nation. Motorway and high-speed train are part of the world's accepted means of human movement. In 1908, Henry Ford produced the first of his 15 million Model T Fords in his Detroit factory. It heralded another revolution, private motor transport, within the reach of ordinary people. Not all of us could afford that, but that's the sort of thing that it's become increasingly the idea that the family car is the expected possession of millions of people. The space age. In 1903, the Wright brothers flew for a few seconds at Kitty Hawk. 12 years later, men were flying at 120 miles an hour at 20,000 feet. Then on the 2nd of March, 1969, supersonic commercial transport was underway in Concorde. 1942, in Hitler's secret research island of Penemünde Island, the V-2 rocket was launched. And the commander, the German commander of the project, said, today, the space age has been born. In 1957, Russia launched Sputnik 1, Earth's first Earth satellite into space. In 1961, on the 12th of April, Yuri Gagarin became the first man to orbit the Earth in his Vostok spacecraft. In 1969, on the 20th of July, Neil Armstrong stepped upon the surface of the moon. In 1977, Voyager 2 was launched. And in between 1980 and 81, it photographed Jupiter and Saturn and is now moving beyond our solar system into outer space. And of course, you know, in April 1981, Columbia, the first reusable spacecraft, was launched. And so, you know, the whole frontiers of space travel and space research have been thrown wide open, which were unbelievable and thought of at the beginning of the century. Communications is another mark of this technological whirlwind that we're in. 1901, Marconi demonstrated the wireless communication across the Atlantic. Today, there are more than 600 million radios worldwide. In 1926, Logie Baird demonstrated a crude form of television. Today, there are more than 250 million televisions worldwide. In 1962, Telstar communication satellite was launched. Today, many satellites encircle the globe, aiding communication, weather reporting, and military observation. The record player, the cassette recorder, videos, all these kind of things are at the hands of millions and millions of people, not only communicating information, but shaping the way people think. The cinema started off this century with the silent movie. Soon talkies came in 1927, and then widescreen and stereo sound, so that Mickey Mouse and Donald Duck have become known the world around as celebrities. The whole screen thing has been an equal force in shaping the way people around the world think and think about the age in which they live and shape the values that they have. Bookstores of the world are flooded with magazines and newspapers. The paperback has become an easy way of communicating ideas in book form. And of course, the cassette, they said the paperback and the cassette have become probably two of the most important means of communicating ideas in the world today. Cheap, easy to distribute and to spread around. 1946 saw the advent of the electronic computer. Transistors were invented in 1948, silicon chips in 1962. And they're so small they can go through the eye of a needle. Electrostatic word processors, 1963. All of these have built up a communications revolution, which we now call information technology, which people have described as all microelectric devices which can produce, store, and obtain and transmit data in words, pictures, and numbers. And so there's this whole new thing, whole new world of communication that we now experience and take for granted, which was unknown at the beginning of our century. And then there are the medicine men. 1921, Alexander Fleming discovered penicillin, which has influenced medicine, you know, enormously. 1922, Frederick Banting discovered insulin, which has helped in diabetes. In 1927, viruses of diseases like polio were isolated, which have brought a whole new hope of health to so many people. Man has a much greater understanding now of how the human body works. Advances in physics gave hospitals X-ray machines. In December 1967, the first heart transplant was done, which gave the whole new era of sort of spare part surgery. And in 1978, Louise Brown was born, the first little girl who was, of course, the first test tube baby. The World Health Organization works to fight diseases in the poorest nations of the world, trachoma, yaws, malaria, sleeping sickness, and other diseases like this. There's been an enormous decrease in infant mortality. There's been an increase in the lifespan of many people, particularly the old, because of medical care. There's been the development of cheap and effective contraception, which had an enormous effect on the social attitudes and the social behavior of people today. So not only have there been these advances, but their influences on society have been enormous. Now all this brings us the kind of world we now live in, which has been described very cleverly, I think, as being a global village. We live in a universal world culture is beginning to develop. Communication and technology has given us a new consciousness, a new global consciousness. News of events in one part of the world are transmitted instantly to another part of the world. The human race has literally become a neighborhood. And not only has communication done this, but world trade and world banking systems has brought the peoples of the world together into one culture and one sort of unifying force increasingly. There's a strong cultural flow between the nations. Americans adorn their homes with African sculptures. Clothes designers use Polynesian motifs. Medical science uses ancient Indian drugs as tranquilizers. Zen Buddhism has many followers in the West. Teenagers in Buenos Aires or Prague all wear denim jeans and carry ballpoint pens. There's a strong cross-cultural flow. But also, there is this world culture that's emerging as well, which is increasingly adopting what we would call a Western way of life. It's been described as being urban, as being industrial, as being democratic, and being secular, and all of it being science-based. So let's look at that in a little bit more detail. First of all, urban. The world is rapidly becoming an urbanized planet. People are moving from the countryside into cities. There are over 163 cities which have over 1 million inhabitants. They account for 9% of the world population. It's estimated by the year 2000, 45% of the world population will live in cities of 20,000 plus, and that by 2050 AD, 90% of the world population will live in such cities. That with 25% of the world population by 2000 living in cities of 100,000 plus, rising to 50% of the world population by 2050 AD. And yet, the polarizing of the world's population into huge cities is only indication, not only an indication of enormous wealth, but also of extreme poverty. 12% of the world's population live in shanty towns around the edges of the world's cities. This is one-third of the world's cities' population. Increasingly, the world's skyline is one of skyscrapers, office blocks, and Hilton hotels. So it's an urban civilization. But also, it's industrial. The Industrial Revolution began roughly around the 1700s. And it was a movement of an economy from based on agriculture to one that was based on manufactured goods and commerce. Now, Britain led the world in that transition. But by the turn of the century, Britain all tooled up in industry. Her tools needed replacing, and countries like Germany, America, and Japan were moving forward and advancing and taking over Britain in this role as being a major industrial nation. But these industrial nations have become a model for third world countries and that to copy and to shape and to become like. Increasing wealth and acceleration of productive power has been possible by because man has increasingly got control of the physical world in which he lives using science and technology. He's been able to exploit the Earth's resources. Here we see a robot production line. The increase of wealth and acceleration of productive power have really been possible to make this happen. Industries has established a hold on society. Mass production, mechanization, and robots are replacing workers in factories so that we can have more and more goods, cheaper and cheaper. Now, not only has science enabled man to have more things, but it's also changed sort of the morality of the 20th century, so that success is measured by countries that are able to produce goods, manufactured goods, on the basis of raw materials. Progress is measured in terms of technological advance. Thirdly, it's democratic. For the first time in history, every part of the globe has become involved in one sort of political process. Modern communication has mixed all the states into the affairs of one another. We really are one world as never before. Nations are linked by things like the common market, the Warsaw Pact, the Commonwealth, the United Nations. Increasingly, monarchies are giving way to republics. Empires are giving way to democratic states. The old structures are crumbling, new are taking their place. Democracy has become a jargon word. In fact, it's used to cover everything from sort of military juntas to parliaments to dictatorships to one-party states to tribalism to coalitions. It's all called democracy, and people have this impression that some way they are in control of the process of government that is taking place around them. Probably one of the good things that has come out of it, that because of the stress on democracy, it has increased the opportunity of education. So more people are able to read and write than before, and they're able to think things through and ask the questions which centuries before they didn't think they had the right to ask. And voting at least gives people the illusion of the fact they have some say in the government that is controlling them. Then the final mark is of it being a secular, science-based, in its thinking, culture. There's been a decline in formal religion. All religions, not just Christianity, have been attacked by science and have had to face science. Islam has suffered greatly in this way. Spiritual and religious commitment is now viewed as a purely personal thing. Prior to this century, religion and the state were usually inseparably linked. Now states are secular and humanist. Values have moved from being spiritual to being economic. Law has become sociological. Democracy giving us a 51% morality. You know, something is right if most people think it is right. And so we find this is the case in both sort of communist and capitalist cultures. Both believe that man is great, that man can achieve on his own either a communist utopia or the American dream. And out of this is born the Coca-Cola culture, which is industrial-based, it's a consumer society, has mass production, marketing and credit are the watchwords. Marketing with its glossy adverts try and whet the appetites of the world just a little more than you need for the products of the technological age. Mass production means are the way in which these desires are met, by putting them on the market store. Credit is the way by which people are encouraged to buy more and more in this Coca-Cola culture. The affluent society has been born out of the womb of technology and put within the grasp of millions previously undreamt of luxuries. Cars, cameras, Coca-Cola, refrigerators, detergents, dishwashers, package holidays, disposable nappies. They're all available to anyone who wants them if they've got the money. Now, how do we as Christians view this society in the perspective of the kingdom of God? How can such a society continue when its enjoyment is demanded by an ever-increasing world population, and yet the culture is based on finite resources? These are the questions that face us. Now, that's a very important force that has shaped this century. But another one is the storm of war. And our century began by the war to end all wars, as it was called. The beginning of the 19th century and throughout the 19th century, there was relative peace. Britain ruled the world. And because the huge British Empire encircled the globe, there was a great deal of political peace worldwide. Other nations as well had huge chunks of the world in their grasp, so that Europe was the centre of the world, and it reached out its arms and embraced so many parts of the globe. And this gave a great deal of security. It also meant a great deal of exploitation. But in 1914, the old empires and the new states were beginning to strain to increase their wealth, their size, and their security. And so they were prepared, in fact, to use force, if necessary, in order to secure a strong hold on what they'd already got, and if possible, get more. They built new weapons. They conscripted huge armies to achieve their ends. And these rivalries came to a head at the beginning of the First World War. In July 1914, the states of Europe confronted each other. On one hand, there was Germany, Austria, and Italy. On the other hand, there was Britain, France, and Russia. And remember, their influence reached out around the globe. Something was going to give. The tinder was dry. And what it took was actually the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand at Sarajevo to ignite the whole thing into an almighty explosion, which was, in the end, First World War. At that moment, Europe was at her height in wealth and power and global control. All the nations all over the world were dependent on Europe in some way. but the conflict burst, and the whole world found itself engulfed in what was called the Great War. Before the war was over, 30 nations with a combined population of 1,400 million people spread over six continents were drawn into a conflict. People went into war with tremendous optimism. They thought it'll soon be over. And yet it saw the costliest battles in human history. In 1916, the Battle of the Somme saw 400,000 men die to gain literally 120 square miles of land. In 1917, saw 240,000 men lost to gain only 50 square miles. The final total was staggering. Of the soldiers, there were 10 million dead and 20 million wounded. Of the civilians, there were 10 million who died of cholera, typhus, influenza, malnutrition, and famine. Never in history had war so devastated civilization. The social impact on families who lost husbands and sons and fathers, you know, was enormous, and we feel the effect of that today. It was just incredible. This sort of set the stage for so many of the 20th century events. During that war, there was the overthrow of four empires, the German, the Austrian, the Russian, and the Turkish Empire. It heralded the end of imperialism. It fueled the communist revolution in Russia, as we'll see. It brought the nations of Africa and Asia into world affairs. And countries like America and Japan made quite a killing out of the First World War, which set them, you know, in quite a good place for events in the future. It was hoped, of course, that the armistice, which was signed on the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month of 1919, would bring to an end the war that would end all wars and that there would be peace. But in event, an attempt was made to preserve peace. The League of Nations was founded. America did a great deal to try and promote sort of world peace. But it didn't happen. And actually, the conflict didn't end then. In fact, the conflict that began in 1914 didn't, in fact, end until 1945. It sort of flowed right on really unendingly through that period. So there is this one conflict rather than sort of two world wars in reality. Now, during the period of what we could say between the wars, spectres rose on the horizon. Nations had been damaged by war. There was terrific social crisis. Money and all these other things the economy had been eroded. And so the scene was set for men who stood up and said, I will bring you security. I will bring you freedom. I will take you out of the injustice that this war has left you in. The scene was set for those people. And so we see the rise of fascism, particularly in Italy to begin with. Italy has seen terrific social disruption. The cost of living had risen 500% since 1915. There was high taxation, unemployment, strikes in the factories, dissatisfaction on the land. Benito Mussolini said that he had the answer, and so he formed his fascist party in Milan in 1919. His black shirts took their name from the Roman symbol for the discipline and the authority of the state. He went in, he broke up political meetings that were run by anybody. He said the communists are going to take over the nation. I will stop it if nobody else will. He had a tremendous skill at whipping up enthusiasm and emotion. And in the end, he said he would establish a fascist government. In 1922, he became prime minister. In 1925, he eliminated all opposition, often by murder and torture where necessary. He declared himself Il Duce, the leader, and his he said that he would bring about the rebirth of the Roman Empire. He succeeded initially to get amazing results. There were good harvests, land was reclaimed, railways and roads were improved. He had this flamboyant style. And in 1929, he even got the Pope to agree to recognize fascist Italy. In Germany, the Nazi movement was rising. Germany had been grossly humiliated at the end of the First World War. You know, I often wonder what would have happened if the people of God had said it is an unjust basis on which the Treaty of Versailles was signed in 1919. Because it was the injustice of that treaty that gave Hitler the grounds to be able to establish the Nazi Party and say, I will give Germany back her dignity once again. Germany faced huge debts of £6,000 million in war damages that she was forced to repay to other nations. She was disarmed, her territories were split up amongst other people. Now, Hitler launched his German Workers' Party in 1919. His brown shirts increasingly gained power. By 1932, the Nazis were the largest political party. He proclaimed himself the Führer in 1934, and he ordered all the soldiers in the German army to take an oath of personal allegiance to him. Now, like Mussolini, he was a master of propaganda. He promised to raise a new, pure Aryan nation that would be free from Jews and communists. He ended unemployment very easily. He conscripted everybody, or he put them in work camps. He built autobahns. Everything seemed going really well, but of course he knew he was tooling up for war, preparing for conflict. Across the other side of the globe, there was Japan, the land of the rising sun. At the close of the 19th century, Japan had made a meteoric transition from feudalism to westernization. The nation was put on a footing with the West at incredible pace, mainly because of a very high level of literacy. She adopted the Western calendar, decimal currency, established foundries, cotton mills, factories, rail and postal and telegraph systems, made a state army and navy, and established a Western-style legal system. And all this very, very quickly, so that she rose to a very high position in the world. Now, Japan's ambitions were boundless. She beat the Russians in 1905, she held Korea, she stationed an army in China, and the Great War gave Japan a tremendous boost forward because while Europe was fighting, she had her factories going at full pelt, making arms for the West to use, and of course gained a tremendous amount of wealth and prestige that way. But Japan developed too quickly. The population left the land and the fishing and moved into the towns and into the cities. Food prices doubled during the war, particularly the price of rice. The population was increasing by 1 million a year. There were earthquakes, there was unemployment, there was shortage of raw materials. And the Japanese said the only answer was that she needed more land. And so, in 1931, news broke out that Japanese troops had occupied the whole of Chinese Manchuria, and the spectre was there for what was going to happen very soon afterwards. Now, in Spain, civil war took place during this time. One of the great tragedies, I believe, of the whole of this century. Between 1936 and 1939, there was this tragedy that really broke Spain's heart. And it became symbolic of so much conflict during this century, especially the German bombing of Guernica in 1937, of which this is Picasso's painting and sort of reflection on the horror of the first time, really, of civilian populations being decimated in great numbers. There were crippling conditions expressed in Salvador Dali's painting here. Unemployment, the landless braceros, made Spain a hotbed for political unrest. There were communists, there were socialists, there were anarchists, there were idealists, all wanting to throw off the nationalist status quo. The Spanish Civil War was unique in as much as it didn't rise directly out of the aftermath of the First World War. It was tragic because of 3 years of fighting saw 500,000 people dead and eventually Franco taking away all some liberty really from the nation. It was also prophetic because Germany in the Spanish War tested her air force in battle conditions, bombing Guernica, as we've said. Italy committed 60,000 troops. The Russians sent in troops but discovered there were flaws in many of their weapons and so withdrew them but got them put right so that in the Second World War they were able to defend themselves. And so we see the shadows are lengthening across the world again for the conflict to continue. And so we move into global war and the conflagration that took place in the Second World War. Italy, Germany and Japan presented themselves as the have-nots. We need more land, more rights. In 1931, Japan moved into China. In 1935, Italy moved into Abyssinia. And in 1939, Germany moved into Poland, and the Second World War was on. Now, this World War was the most devastating conflict in human history. 70 million men fought in it. 30 million soldiers and civilians died in it. And if you count the figures of those people who were missing or were the victims of bombing and extermination and deportees and the victims of epidemics, the total death toll was about 40 million. Germany lost 8% of her population. Russia lost 10% of her population. The Second World War truly was global. USA and Japan were fully engaged this time. The entire world was in flames, not just Europe. The Pacific, Russia, North Africa were all involved. The airplane was a major weapon in this war, for the first time bombing civilian populations indiscriminately with horrifying consequences. And here are two posters displaying how they felt about civilian bombing. The Great War jarred the world order that existed before. The Second World War brought it to all these old systems to collapse. So a whole new world order was beginning to emerge at the end of the Second World War. Now, the conflict in Europe ended on the 8th of May 1945, but the Japanese fought on. But at 8:15 a.m. on the 6th of August in 1945, the Americans unleashed the atomic bomb upon Hiroshima. They'd been developing it secretly in a New Mexico research station, and they dropped it out of the sky. Just two planes were flying. And as a result of a single explosion, which was 2,000 times more powerful than any bomb that had ever been used before, destroying in one blast 68,000 people, and it gave radiation damage to thousands more. You know, the whole thinking of war in people's minds, you know, was changed. People were shattered. People were stunned by this. 3 days later, on the 9th of August, a second atomic bomb was dropped on the seaport of Nagasaki, killing another 30,000 people in a single explosion, and, of course, radiation damage on many thousands more. The Japanese, as the result of this, surrendered unconditionally on the 2nd of September 1945. Now, the era of conflict was over, and yet there was this mushroom cloud of, and this chill of fear that a whole new era of conflict underneath the shadow of an ultimate Holocaust was upon the world. And so the world reached an impasse in conflict. And we moved from an era of conflict into a war of nerves. Then the most dramatic result of the Second World War was where we have Russia and America facing each other across Europe. And America being the only nation that can really stand and hold back Russia from her ambitions of reaching out and taking control of the whole of Europe, which she wanted to do in the aftermath of the Second World War. In 1945, communist guerrillas were in Greece. There was a communist takeover in Czechoslovakia. And there was a threat to West Berlin. The alliance that there had been between Britain, France, America and Russia during the Second World War disintegrated, and the world was divided. There was the Iron Curtain established, and people said the chill that was around made them feel that they were in the middle of a Cold War. Now, symbolic of this international confrontation was the city of Berlin, the heart of East Germany. There stood this city divided on one half, occupied by the communists, on the other by the Allies, Britain, France, and USA. It was a casualty of the past, and yet symbolic of the future. In 1959, the communists built a wall across Berlin to divide the city, to prevent the East German refugees escaping to the West. And really, this city is a microcosm of the international tension that there is even to today in the world. Now, the conflict, though, has not always been passive, as we shall see. In every continent, there's been a conflict of ideology fueled by social change. And there's been Vietnam, there's been Afghanistan, there's now Central America and other places. Behind this Cold War, there was the arms race, this force of fear of nuclear armament. America initially only shared her nuclear secrets with Britain, but by 1949, Russia had exploded her own nuclear device. Between 1954 and 55, both sides had developed hydrogen weapons, so that within 10 years of Hiroshima, the nuclear threat in the world was vastly increased. There have been disarmament conferences, there have been SALT talks, but little has yet been done to halt the incredible arms race. In 1962, there was enough nuclear weaponry to destroy the whole Earth. Both sides justify their huge arsenal, saying they're necessary to deter the other side from starting a war. Since 1970, smaller weapons have been developed, nuclear weapons, more flexible ones, which in fact have made the nuclear situation much more unstable than it ever was before. And there's been what we call proliferation, which nations like France and China and other countries also developing nuclear weapons. How long will it be, we all know, before guerrilla groups or something like that get hold of atomic weapons. Now, the balance of power is the obsession with the superpowers. No side must get too much advantage. In 1981, it was said the USA had 9,000 nuclear bombs and warheads. The USSR had 7,000. And SIPRI, the Stockholm Institute for Peace Studies, said a couple of years ago that they guaranteed that if one side got a technical advance in which they knew they could win, they could not afford not to start a war because of the amount of money that is committed to the development of nuclear weapons. It is quite a sobering thought. And yet, parallel to the arms race, there's been a huge groundswell of opinion against the bomb. The campaign of nuclear disarmament, CND, with its very distinctive symbol, has become international. Founded in Britain, it had its first Easter marches in 1958. From the Nuclear Weapons Research Establishment in Aldermaston to Trafalgar Square, there were 50,000 people. In 1960, there were 100,000. And of course, with the possibility of cruise missiles coming to Europe, we now have the Women's Peace Camp at Greenham Common, we have the People's Peace Camp at Molesworth, and there's a whole protest saying we must not have nuclear weapons, the whole CND movement. Now, the political attempt to control the world situation has come through the United Nations. It says in its charter that it is to try and bring an end to the scourge of war, to bring about human rights. It seeks to guarantee the freedoms from want, from fear, of speech, and of religious belief. Now, it's done little to do much, really, about the prevention of conflict, although it has made quite a few contributions in terms of, you know, social and educational and world health programs, which has marked the world in which we live. Karl Marx died in London in 1883, but his shadow falls long across our century. He sought to establish utopia in the world. He believed it could come by the process of revolution. He said that history was in fact revolution. A class of society would be born out of a struggle between those, the wage-earning classes, and the people, the rich and the landed classes. And so his writings fueled many idealistic and young thinkers in Europe, and the spark was struck in Russia. It took root, his writings took root amongst young Russians wanting to overthrow the Tsar. Prominent among them was Lenin. And out of the tragedy and humiliation that Russia suffered in the Great War, through the bread riots in 1917 in Petrograd, a revolution was ignited in Russia. by 1917, the Bolsheviks, the Red Guards, led by Lenin, had gained control. By 1923, all opposition to them was put aside, and the Soviet Socialist Republic was formed in Russia, which has had a tremendous impact on our age. Lenin died in 1924. He set out to liberate the Russian people and to set off a chain reaction of revolution across Europe. In fact, that didn't happen, and as a result, Russia ended up being isolated from the rest of the world. In 1931, he said that Russia must advance technologically. He said they are 50 to 100 years behind the West. He said, if we don't, we will perish. And he started a series of five-year programs. He built mines and mills and brick factories and cement plants and power stations and forced the nation of Russia into the 20th century at a most colossal cost. In fact, when I've been researching this, I think the cost that Russia has paid this century has struck my heart more than any other single fact. Unemployment was solved by labour camps. He forced agriculture to go collective. He was actually exporting wheat to the West in the 1930s to buy industrial machinery while 12 million Russians were starving within that nation. That was the price that he paid. Anybody, of course, who resisted Stalin was hounded and persecuted. And in fact, Solzhenitsyn has estimated that between 1917 and 1959, 66 million Russians died in death camps, which is the most incredible thing. But not only that, but after, you know, as Russia went into the Second World War, there was an increased price to pay, with 20 million Russians dying in the Second World War in their stand against Hitler. So the price that this nation has paid during this century is almost unbelievable. In fact, in Moscow in 1957, when Sputnik was launched, a wry joke went around the streets of Moscow. They said, "Good, now we are in space, perhaps we can have shoes." China is the other theatre of communism. This nation embraces one quarter of the world's population. In 1911, Sun Yat-sen toppled the Manchu Empire and attempted to make China a democratic nation. But of course, there were others. When Sun Yat-sen died, Chiang Kai-shek took over from him. Other men were there, like Mao Zedong, who wanted to turn China into a communist state. Of course, he was resisted, and in 1934, they were forced to make the long march into the Shenzhen province to wait their time. Now, the communists suffered terribly during the Second World War at the hands of the Japanese. Peasants in the countryside suffered also under corrupted local administrators. But using brilliant tactics, Mao was able to win over at the end of the Second World War. So that in 1949, Chiang Kai-shek had to flee to Formosa, or Taiwan as it became, and the Chinese People's Republic was established on the mainland. Now again, like in Russia, Mao also tooled up China to be a Western, you know, parallel with the Western nations in the Great Leap Forward. Factories, commune farms, they doubled crops and livestock, reclaimed land, built roads, rail, and air transport, simplified the language script, and built the largest army in the world equipped with nuclear weapons. 1966 saw the beginning of the proletarian cultural revolution, with the Red Guards urging the nation to purify bureaucracy from soft Western ideas. The Little Red Book became carried by every self-respecting Chinese and many people in the West. Hundreds of thousands were read in the West as well. 1976, Mao died, and a new atmosphere prevailed, which has loosened many of the strong barriers that the bamboo curtain had set up. But the sky is very much red. Communism, in the form of either Marxism or Maoism, has influenced hundreds of thousands of radical thinkers in probably every nation of the world, as we shall see. Numerous revolutionary movements in Asia, Africa, Latin America, and Europe. Mixing nationalism with communism has been potent, and also mixing atheism with utopianism has made communism a real challenge to the church in this century. It's one of the big forces we've got to contend with. But revolution has not only come under the banner of communism, it's also been through the desire for emerging nations to be independent. Now, this is probably one of the most amazing changes as well that's taken place during this century. 1914 saw many nations saying, "We want self-determination." It was a watchword for most of the non-white nations in the world, but of course they were ruled by European overlords. But the Second World War really broke those fetters. It's been said that before 1945, 99.5% of the non-Western nations were ruled by Western powers. By 1969, 99.5% of the non-Western nations were independent. That is the most incredible social change you can imagine. And that has brought us now the creation of what we call the Third World. And of course it's been fueled and affected by this global consciousness that technology and communication has brought. And it's made a major impact on the thinking of the church worldwide. We now talk about an indigenous church, which, whereas before we always thought of as the church being ruled by, you know, the big white man sort of from Europe. Now let's look at some of these changes. In Asia, in 1945, only had four independent nations free of colonial rule. It's been in ferment over the last 30 years with nationalism and communism keeping the pot boiling. Asia has taken a very anti-Western stance, quite often a paradoxical one. Often they've wanted all the benefits of Western technology, but they haven't wanted any of the to be under the rule of sort of Western power or control, particularly nations like Thailand and the Philippines and Indonesia. India is probably one of the most interesting nations, this whole stand for independence, because of the brilliant guidance into independence they had under Gandhi. Here's plus 400 million people stirring for self-government. And this little man called them back to their heritage. He said the heart of India lies in the village. He said non-violence is at the heart of Indian philosophy. And communicating that to these millions of people, he was able to free India from the control of Britain in the most amazing way. I'll just sort of an aside, if you've not seen the film Gandhi, you must see it. It's the most incredible film, the most amazing story. He and Socrates are my two non-Christian heroes. He's an amazing man. There's a lot to learn from this fellow. You know, if the people of God were half as wise as this man was, we'd see some changes. It was, of course, only after the Second World War that independence was finally granted, August the 15th, 1947. But sadly, the subcontinent was divided into two nations, Pakistan, which was Muslim, and India, which was Hindu. This meant the migration of millions of people in and out of their respective countries. 500,000 people died in the fighting that took place in the changeover and establishing of these nations, which broke Gandhi's heart. And of course, you know, it was a real tragedy. If only Jinnah had allowed, you know, one India instead of a divided India. But that's another story. Of course, Gandhi himself was assassinated, thankfully, I'll say this, by a Hindu. What would have happened if he'd been assassinated by a Muslim? We don't know. In 1948. Pakistan, of course, was geographically divided between East and West, and that caused its own conflict, not only with India, but amongst herself. And in 1971, East Pakistan faced civil war and declared independent Bangladesh, Free Bengal, which brought a real tragedy and became a focus again for many people in the West of the tragedy that was going on in the Third World. And here we see, you know, the atrocities that were carried out in the name of freedom in a football stadium in Bangladesh. But it became a symbol of the Third World struggle for identity and freedom. And India very much illustrates the problems of so many Third World nations struggling for independence and freedom. Communism, of course, has been an enormous force in India. And so has nationalism. And they've been struggling. And many young people look to communism for solutions. They believe here is a hope for our peoples. And China becoming a superpower has also fueled communist ambitions in Asia. But of course, it's brought tremendous conflict. Malaya in 48, 55. Korea in 50 and 53. Vietnam, 30 years of war, 45 to 73, under the French and the Americans. Kampuchea saw 3 million people die. And of course, more recently, there's been conflict in Afghanistan. These children running, that girl's torn her clothes off because of the napalm gas that has been used and is burning her body. Then Africa. This continent has 300 million people in it. And in 1945, again, only four states were independent. And yet throughout the 1970s, the cry for that continent was black majority rule. Much of the fighting has gone on to bring about independence. There was Mau Mau in Kenya in the 50s. Algeria saw the FLN. Zimbabwe, it was the Patriotic Front of guerrillas. Angola still has SWAPO in it. But there was often conflict after independence as well as before independence, because tribalism didn't mix well with the idea of one man, one vote. And so in Zaire, you had the Simba uprising in 60 to 64. Nigeria had the Biafra revolt in 67 to 70. And Uganda had the horrors of Amin between 71 and 79. Of course, there's still conflict in Namibia, in Western Sahara, in Chad, and in the Horn of Africa today. And as a result, you know, many African states have a one-party system ruled by military juntas, fueled often by help from Russia and China, who say they will support the African nations. And then Latin America. This continent of over 298 million has not been such a force in the same way as Asia and Africa in world politics. And yet it has contributed to the world's wealth in the most amazing way. Someone has said that all the silver mined from South America could make a bridge, a two-lane highway bridge, stretching from South America to Spain, which is quite amazing. That is the contribution to the world's wealth that she has made. Now, revolution is in the lifeblood of Latin America, it says. It mixes the music of the guitar with the staccato of the machine gun. Revolutions for independence and national identity began as far back as 1800 in Mexico, and largely have achieved their ends. In the 1940s, most of the old dictators and landowning classes had lost their power. But the revolutions continued. In the 60s and 70s, it was for military governments. And the revolutions still continue. Bolivia, in fact, has had 180 revolutions in 160 years, if you can believe that. And today, the revolution in Latin America is a revolution within a revolution. It's a revolution for social justice, for identity, for human rights, for economic freedom. And the new Latin American revolutionary is not the farmer and the miner as in the past, but the college student, the artist, the radical priest who's trying to put theory into practice. The popular singer Buenjo Cruz said, "I leave my guitar and embrace the gun in order to bring freedom to my land." And of course, they've been inspired by men like Che Guevara, who was killed in Bolivia in October 1967. But Latin America has become a battlefield of ideologies where the winner makes his own interpretation of slogans like social justice, human rights, and freedom. We're up to looking at Islam and Israel as another revolutionary force in the 20th century in the world we live in. Now, sorry if I'm sometimes stumbling over my words because the speed that I'm trying to go at, but I'll try and cut corners other ways than that. Okay, now Palestine, as it was known at the beginning of this century, has been the stage of enormous significance in this century. Not only because of the repercussions that have taken place there, but the reverberations of which have been felt right around the world. And what we have found there has been the interface between Israel, the Jews, and the Muslim world of Islam. But behind the stages have also been the superpowers of the United States and Russia. And so this little tract of land has become a very, very important flashpoint of our time. Now the Jew, scattered throughout the Middle East and Europe, is of course an enigma. For centuries the Jew has been a butt of persecution. But he's left his unique mark on this century. Many, Karl Marx came from a Jewish family, Einstein was a Jew, and so you've gone. So many significant people of our century have been of Jewish background. There are only 18 million Jews worldwide, with 58% of them living in the Western world. Now, in 1917, the Balfour Declaration suggested a national homeland for the Jews. At the beginning of this century, a trickle of Jews went back to Palestine, which increased in number under the British mandate at the end of the First World War. But slowly, increasingly, there was this growing spirit of Zionism amongst the Jews worldwide, a desire for a homeland and a desire to go back to Palestine and make Israel. Now, 1945, the Holocaust of the Second World War saw a total of 6 million Jews dead. Names like Belsen, Dachau, Ravensbrück, Treblinka, Auschwitz, Flossenbürg, and so many others bring a chill when you just hear the names, because you know of the millions of Jews who met their death either in gas chambers or in experimental under experimental conditions because of the ruthless extermination of them by the Nazis. The Holocaust was not only the high point of centuries of persecution, but it also, again, fueled the determination of Jews for a national homeland. In 1947, the British withdrew from Palestine, which was in the grips of a guerrilla war, and gradually, fighting for their lives, the Jews established for themselves a homeland. And on the 14th of May 1948, they proclaimed the creation of the modern State of Israel, which became recognized by the United Nations. Now, parallel to them, of course, is Islam. Islam, unlike communism, is a most significant force in the 20th century, but has roots that go back very, very much longer. There are 800 million Muslims worldwide. 17% of the world population are Muslim, the majority religion of 35 nations of the world, stretching from the coast, the Atlantic coast of North Africa, deep into Central Asia, and down into the South Pacific. There are 25 million Muslims in Europe, and it is said by that, in fact, they have both the will and the resources to make Europe Muslim within the next 50 years. That is their stated aim. In Britain alone, there are 300 mosques and over 1 million Muslims. That's a very important development and force that's shaping the world today. As I said, Islam goes back to the 7th century AD. But this century has seen the most amazing resurgence of Islamic faith. At the beginning of this century, Muslims felt themselves dispossessed. They were without heart. Their faith had seemed to run to seed. They genuinely believed something had gone wrong with history. And then they got back to their roots. They rediscovered Muhammad and the kind of man that he was. And a whole Muslim renaissance has been born in the early decades of this century. And then fueled by the incredible economic power that they have got grasp of, they are now in new heart, and they really believe history is flowing in their direction. I just ask you, if you were a Muslim today, what would you think about the spiritual forces at work and where victory was going to be? You know, it's quite an interesting thought, but it's a very, very important one to recognize. Now, the flashpoint between Islam and Israel is, of course, the Middle East. The Arabs had occupied Palestine for 1,300 years. The earliest trickle of Jews sparked off resistance. And, of course, as the Jews firmly put their roots down, so opposition from Palestinian Arabs who felt themselves dispossessed increased. In 1945, the Arabs formed a league. Their prime aim was to expel the Jews from Palestine. A proclamation of the State of Israel in 1945 gave excuse for a full-scale war. However, the aftermath left Israel with more land than they'd had before, incredibly. And the treaty signed in 1949 brought a huge influx of Jewish immigrants into Israel, but left dispossessed over a million Palestinian Arabs. And I think that is something, you know, is significant and is important, and I think is one of the tragedies as well of our times. June 1967, Israel launched the Lightning Six-Day War, in which he recaptured the whole of Jerusalem and territory down to the Suez Canal. But then, of course, on the 6th of October 73, the Yom Kippur War saw an Arab backlash and retaliation. And yet again, Israel roused herself and, after initial defeat, brought about an incredible conquest, which ultimately took place under the atmosphere of a nuclear alert. Now, Sadat's visit to Jerusalem in 77 and the Camp David Peace Initiative has eased the tension, certainly, between Israel and Egypt. But it's also split the Muslim world. There's been a threatened Soviet invasion, threatened by the Soviet invasion into Afghanistan in 79. There's been the Iran-Iraq Gulf War in 1980. And also, although Israel has got more security to her south, that has meant she's concentrated on establishing, there's been more conflict in the north. June 81 saw an attack on an Iraqi nuclear reactor in Baghdad. December 81, Israel annexed the Golan Heights, and of course, throughout, there's been the conflict with the PLO in Lebanon, which is still, you know, very much unresolved right to this date, especially in Beirut, you know, during 81. All this has led to the oil crisis. It's been a catalyst of the world energy crisis. Western industrial nations like America, Europe and Japan have petroleum-based economies, and the Arab nations hold the bulk of the world's oil in their hands. In the 50s, these complexes, which were pioneered by Western nations, were nationalized so that they controlled them. And of course, because of America's support of Israel, they turned the taps down and held back the supply of oil, and the whole energy crisis came right to the surface. as a result of this conflict. And of course, it's allowed huge sums of money to flow into Muslim exchequers. And of course, they are now able to call the tune on Western economy. And they hold so much power in their hand. And behind that power lies the faith of Islam, which they are determined to see spread worldwide. Now, Islam has had a conflict between its traditions and the West. And this conflict between traditional Islam and westernization is spotlighted in the conflict that we see taking place in Iran today. The Shah exploited his enormous oil reserves. 25 million petrodollars a day it was pouring into Iran between 72 and 78. In 10 years, he spent $20 billion on arms. And yet he had the world's worst record on human rights. In 25 years, he spent $3 billion on social projects, but only in the towns and cities. So people flocked into the cities, again bringing terrific social chaos. Western ideas were encouraged. And yet in Iran, there were deep-seated orthodox feelings about Islam. And so resistance was building up against him in the countryside, in the cities, amongst the religious people. Now, outside of Iran, there was the Ayatollah Khomeini, who'd been expelled because of his resistance to the Shah. And yet he sent in cassettes of his message saying, rise up and revolt against this man, return to your roots in Islam. And so this whole groundswell of revolution against westernization took place. On the 8th of September in 1978, martial law was introduced, and yet crowds of up to 2 million people entered the streets of the cities in Iran protesting against the Shah. And on the 1st of February 79, the Ayatollah returned. Islamic law, he said, must be embodied in life. All opposition must be put down. We must submit to his interpretation of the Quran. He says, we are fighting communism as much as the Western world. And so there was a call for a complete cultural revolution. Take the Quran in one hand and your weapons in the other, said the Ayatollah. And so we see this incredible conflict going on in Iran, a desire to get back to their spiritual roots and to fight westernization. Now, actually, Islam stands as one of the great walls against communism in the world today. And yet also, many, many Muslims have tasted westernization, and so the conflict is far from over. And it's going to be interesting to see what happens in Islam worldwide in the years ahead. And so we come and focus in on the global crisis, really, that has come out of all these social changes that have taken place in the 20th century. We are living in a fractured world. In the 80 years of this century, the face of the world has been changed, as we've seen, beyond all recognition. The stability of the 19th century has gone. There's new ways. Change always has pain behind it, and there's been tremendous pain and anguish in our century. There's been wars and revolutions. There's been the shock of the new as far as science is concerned. Some people are full of optimism. Some people believe a whole new age is emerging, throwing off the old. Other people are full of pessimism. They believe a nuclear holocaust is just around the corner. We've sown the wind. Are we about to reap the whirlwind? Now, from our present vantage point, we see a world united by the media and yet divided by politics, economics, and ideas. Politically, the main forces that divide the world are between the United States and Russia. There's this great impasse. And yet there are the third world nations that don't want to submit to either of them and try and be unaligned, and yet they need what these countries can supply in terms of capital investment and expertise. We've got a world divided between the rich and the poor. There's the first world, the Western world with its technology. There's the third world with its poverty, with its desire to become like the first world. The second world is actually a name that's given to the communist countries, but they really stand alongside the first world, this divide between the rich and the poor, in many cases between the black and the white, between the haves and the have-nots. The new freedoms which our age is supposed to have offered have been unequally distributed. Trade and economics link a divided world, but the power behind them lies in the hands of a few. A third of the world owns 80% of its wealth. Rich nations create and control the markets. The resources of the third world are at the mercy and the buying power of the first world. But the point is, economic power does not rest in the hands necessarily of nations. Recently, there was a survey done of the 10 of the 100 largest economic powers in the world. 53 were nations, 47 were multinational companies. Individual countries have power and influence, but they're restricted by political pressure and by finite resources, whereas multinational companies can encircle the globe. They can take from here, they can sell there. They can draw from the resources, they can create markets at will, they can create the kind of consciousness they want amongst people by advertising. The 50 largest multinationals are 21 based in the United States, 17 in Europe, and 6 in Japan. And so there's a whole new phenomena of world power, which really is something, again, unknown before. Now, it's clear the forces that create and control the economic and technical advance are not neutral. Our world's problems aren't just technical and structural. They're to do with relationships between the rich and the poor, and also the relationships between the rich and the poor within countries, not only between rich nations and poor nations. So it's a very, very complex problem. And this brings to the surface all sorts of flashpoints. There are many angry people in the world today because, you know, they feel things are not right. They want changes to take place. There are people behind all these great sweeps and currents within the ocean of sort of the history of our time. People who feel powerless. People who really want changes but don't know what to do. One of the areas is poverty. Now, poverty has marked the human story right from the beginning, but it's as strong and the scar is as clear in our age as at any time in history. It's often been the result in the aftermath of war and of revolution, which has resulted in from the high and the low states of the economic sort of flow that there's been. Science, industry and technology has promised so much, yet the 1930s saw overproduction, falling prices, and so we went into the depression, which shook the world economy. Poverty marked Russia during Stalin's time. When he was trying to put the nation on an industrial footing, 12 million people were allowed to starve to death. Now, our present world recession has shaken the world economy to its roots. And also, in the aftermath of that, there is a great deal of poverty, not only in third world countries, but also in first world countries. And yet the people who suffer most, you know, are the people right at the very bottom of the pile. For all the growth that there has been in this century, during the last 20 years, the lowest 40 and 50% of the world population have suffered most. Their income has the income increase for the lowest two-thirds of humanity has been less than 50 pence per person per year. Which is quite incredible when you think of the inflation rates that the world has seen. So poverty is absolutely a flashpoint in the world today. Closely linked to that is, of course, unemployment. They say the answer to poverty is a four-letter word, jobs. Unemployment and underemployment will affect 500 million people by 1990. 1,000 million new jobs must be created by the end of this century. In the third world, 25 to 30% of the workforce are unemployed or underemployed. And, of course, we've got high technology, automation. So that, in fact, doesn't help matters. There's the chance of more and more unemployment. And, of course, this can be used as a weapon against people who don't want to work for the wages that are on offer. And so the whole employment thing has got a real problem. Added to that, the other side of unemployment is the problem of leisure, if you've got the money and the time and the ability to enjoy it. And someone has said that leisure is as great a threat to the 20th century as the atomic bomb, which is an interesting thought. And so there's this terrific struggle going on as a result of people wanting work, wanting meaning in life, and yet not being able to find it. Sorry, Arthur. Be carried away with myself. There we are. So we move on to population, which is another flashpoint. This really has what they call the demographic explosion has really been a major explosion in our century. The world population peaked in about 75, with a birth rate 30% higher than the death rate. In 1980, the world population was 4.321 million people. it's expected that there will be 6,000 million people in the world by the year 2000. The 1970s, the population was thought to be the major cause of world poverty, wiping out all the benefits of economic development. But this is a simplistic misunderstanding. The truth is that poverty or population, large families, is the result of poverty, not the cause of it. You see, if you lived in a situation where there was no social security, no unemployment pay, no sickness benefit, no old age pension, your children would be your only safeguard against certain death if anything goes wrong, against old age. And so therefore it's no good telling a person who has nothing to fall back on not to have so many children. In India it is estimated you need 7 children to make sure you have one son who will reach marriageable age. And so the whole population problem is something that is not easily answered. It's not simply dishing out more contraceptives as it was thought in the beginning of the 1970s. Of course, the people who have the largest families have the highest infant mortality rate. And so, really, the answer to the population problem is nutrition, health, education, employment, incomes, housing. These are the best forms of contraceptive. Because without that, there will be famine, there will be disease, and there will be war. And linked to that, of course, is the problem of hunger. In the 1960s, the hope was that we'd solve the world's hunger problems by birth control, by farm mechanization, by food aid, and by what they called the Green Revolution, new miracle crops that could be grown. But all of these have been found wanting. Birth control, as I've said, was not accepted because people said, we need children. Until you give us social security and something to fall back on, we must have our children. Food aid, which was flooded into countries by Western nations, it actually doesn't help. It simply depresses the market price. So people growing food in that country can't sell their goods for a decent price, and therefore, you know, what's the point of growing food? And that disrupts the economy. The profit from the Green Revolution all rests with people who've got money, because they depend on fertilizers. The seed themselves cost a great deal of money. You've got to be able to put in irrigation, all this kind of thing. So the rich farmers in those countries make a bomb. The poor farmer is poorer at the end of the day than he was at the beginning because he can't afford it. When he tries to buy these seeds, they don't grow because he hasn't got the technology to back them up with. So all our hopes of the 70s have fallen on dead ground. 460 plus million severely undernourished, half of them were children. But hunger is not the result of too little land and too many mouths to feed, as we've been told so often before. Because during that period, world food production has kept up with the population growth. Even in the hungriest years, there's been enough grain alone to feed everybody with enough calories. China and Taiwan have more people per cultivated acre than India and Bangladesh, but there's hardly any malnutrition in those countries, so it's an organisational thing as much as anything else. As Gandhi said, there's enough for everyone's need, but not enough for everyone's greed. And so and the other problem is often agricultural land in these countries is used to grow things like flowers for export rather than food to feed people in their own countries. So there really is a problem. People will always starve, people will always go hungry where there are unjust systems of distribution. But where, as someone has said, there's a free economy, rich people will never go hungry. Poor people will always starve unless there's some control of the distribution of food. Health, of course, is another flashpoint. The trouble is that most of the health development has been in high technology available to a few people in rich countries. 80% of the world health budget is spent on 20% of the world population who live in cities. 70% of the world population have no access to modern health cure at all. 90% of the world's illnesses are due to inadequate nutrition, water supply, sanitation, immunization, and health education. Those things could relieve most of the world health problems. 250,000 children every year go blind due to a lack of vitamin A, and that could be solved simply by having a handful of green food every day, but it isn't there, and so they suffer in that way. The answer lies in public health primary health care, as it's called, where, like in China, have barefoot doctors who go around and give basic care to people, rather than everything being keyed on sort of high technology in hospitals, which few people have access to. We've got to get away from sort of Western-style medicine. We've got to find answers sort of elsewhere. Education is another flashpoint. It's always been the major ticket to success in the world. If you're educated, you'll get on. If you're not educated, you won't get on. In September 1977 was the first time that more than half the world's children of primary school age were actually receiving education. However, 40% of the third world population are under 15 years of age, compared with 27% in industrial nations. And it's estimated that between 1980 and 1990, while the percentage of illiterate people in the third world will drop from 52% to 49%, the actual world illiteracy problem will increase by a further 46 million people. So we're not keeping pace in any way with our education. But the trouble is, in the third world, they model themselves on the West. They want to have schools like we have. And therefore, their education system only really equips the 20% people who go on to higher education at the expense of the 80% of people who will have no more than primary education. And the thought is now to give primary education that will equip people for their whole life and not simply be geared to getting a few people on into university. But of course, all world education patterns are changing. I mean, I've been teaching recently in a school, and our big problem is unemployment, training people to spend their leisure time. And so the whole education system is in ferment at the moment. The energy crisis is the next flashpoint. I came across a lovely quote some years ago which summed up the energy crisis in a nutshell. It says, you can fuel all the people some of the time and some of the people all the time, but you can't fuel all the people all of the time. And that's the sort of place we are, that, you know, the consumption of fuel exceeds, you know, our supply of it. And really growing and growing, there's this fear that we're going to be a people who end up freezing in the dark. Oil, it's estimated the reserves of oil will run out within the next 30 to 50 years. Of course, that's a projection. We don't know, you know, whether that's definitely the case or not, but it seems to be the sort of skilled assessments at the moment.